Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. You know, I got a little inspiration over the last few weeks. Some friends and I went to check out an exhibit in Los Angeles called the Museum of Failure.
Oh, my God. That's beautiful. Tell me about that.
It was great. It got me thinking about the ego trap that you've so awesomely talked about here. Basically, it's an entire museum dedicated to famous flops. There's a little blurb about each product and why people think it failed.
Yeah.
So it's really cool, too. For example, I didn't know that there was a flavor of Oreo cookies called Swedish Fish.
Oh, my goodness.
Can't imagine why that failed. But what was interesting is a lot of these products, they were failures in the marketplace, but they led to new inventions and to new products that were even better. And so they were a failure, but only from the perspective of that day and age.
Yes. Fabulous. And what a grand concept that is. I got to go down there and see that. That's terrific.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was a wall there too, where people who were going to the museum could write post-it notes about their own failures.
Yeah.
And there was a couple I saw, I took pictures of, you know, there was some, you know, failed relationships. There was one person who went to the address and it was, they went to 904th Street rather than 409th Street. And that was pretty funny.
Got it.
The one that was most amusing was getting a Justin Bieber haircut at age 30.
Okay.
And then unfortunately.
Worth a try. And then
someone had to bring up NBA finals and they said the Golden State Warriors who blew a 3-1 lead in the NBA finals. So I thought of you, Dr. Lyle. And
thank goodness LeBron got it done. So I just made a bunch of enemies, but what do I care?
Especially Rob.
All right. Yeah.
But if you
didn't warm your heart to see Cleveland win one, then oh well, too bad. All right. What do we got going?
It was a fun experience. It just showed me that even if I try my very best and I still utterly fail, there's still a chance I might make it into an entire museum.
That's correct. There you go. There's a silver lining out there.
All right. Well, today we're going to be talking about dreams, meditation, a question about abstract thinking, a little bit about Buddhism. And we've got a listener who's been listening ever since the very beginning, and he sent Dr. Lyle a note. He sent me a note to read to Dr. Lyle.
All right.
So, dear Dr. Lyle, I've been listening to your podcast since the beginning and heard all the episodes and in some cases have listened to more than one. At your request, I also read The Selfish Gene, and just like you, I was captivated by the simplicity and clarity of this idea. And because of you, I've been experimenting with the principles of evolutionary psychology in an educational setting. Mm-hmm. I teach structural engineering design courses, and in the past, I realize now that I was unwittingly promoting an ego trap by suggesting that certain concepts are just plain easy. Mm-hmm. Since listening to you, I've made it a point to let the students know just how difficult these concepts are and how even I, the professor, can make some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Now I emphasize practicing problems and learning from mistakes much more than achieving perfection. Dr. Lyle, this has changed the entire dynamic of my classroom. Students are more willing to ask questions, discuss what it is they don't understand, and it's exciting to me to see them feel relaxed and actually focusing on learning rather than avoiding making mistakes at any cost. My motto to them now is, if you don't make mistakes, you don't need me here. Enjoy making mistakes even more than getting it right, because you'll learn more.
Fantastic. What a fantastic letter. I'm just indebted to this man, I assume. If he's teaching structural engineering, I'm just making an assumption. That's all right. I won't go to Berkeley anytime soon. They won't hang me. But this is just wonderful. That's a very, very heartwarming tale, and I'm just delighted to hear it. Thank you. Thanks for reading that, and thank you very much for writing that.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for writing that in. There was a last paragraph I actually didn't read. It was, I'm curious if you have any comments or suggestions, and appreciate if you could talk about how the principles of evolutionary psychology apply to education, and what else can be done in a classroom to create a better learning environment.
Let's see. I think he's got the gist of the most important issue. So he's got it, and he will tinker with this thing, and he'll, you know, and as people learn about this, they're learning about this now. It's starting to leak its way into education through Carol Dweck's work of Mindset, which is a similar concept, even though it's not, she's not very clear about why, but that's okay. She's got the dynamic right, or pretty much right. There'll be a lot of little fiddling, because there's a little bit of art to this, because we don't want to tell people essentially that something's impossible, because we don't want to actually lower their perceived self-efficacy that they could do it. So we want them to think that maybe they can, maybe they can't, but maybe they, you know, there's a good chance they might not be able to, but they might be able to. I.e., this is just where he's at. He's telling them that this is difficult. It's hard for me. I make mistakes. This is beautiful. It waves a red flag of attack, that I have nothing to lose and everything to gain by really trying hard. And this is what you want. You want the price of failure to be as low as possible, and you want the price of success to be as high as you can make it. And that's actually the fundamental mathematical dynamic that is actually in this equation. So the only thing that I would see in education would be the ability to organize things, for example, on a computer where they would be highly individualized. So you could be hitting the individual at the level of difficulty that they can handle, and that then we would be challenging them and having, like, you could actually bottle this potentially with feedback systems where, you know, unfortunately people would figure it out, but they might not. You could have feedback systems that would actually say, well, we would expect, you know, you have an X percent chance of doing this, and i.e. that you might not be able to. I think that would fire people's, people love to be able to beat the curve. And so I think that sort of thing, to systematize it on an individual basis, would be the next step in something that education could adopt. So anyway, that's just fabulous. And that concept goes so counter to the ways, I can't tell you how many parents and grandparents have come up to me shaking their heads when they hear this, and they feel embarrassed and defensive. That they have done it so differently, that they've been telling their children or grandchildren that they're great and they could do anything. And they walk them right into this trap. And so when they understand and see clearly for the first time that there's a completely different way of doing it, it's disorienting and bizarre. And then I just love that this man, this professor, took this on, experimented with it, saw the logic, and then has had the results that he can see with his own eyes. It's a thing of beauty, and we want everybody to know that is the potential for human excitement and joy in learning and struggling. That it is a great experience to do that if we do not have the price of failure too high. That's a critical lesson that comes out of this. Fabulous.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we are going to move on to the questions. And very first question, Dr. Lyle, what's the purpose of dreaming?
Wow. Well, it's a great question. There's been many theories about this over the decades. I would say most people at this point would say that it could be several things going on at the same time, so it might not be one thing. I will tell you what I think is likely to be part of the case, and then maybe not part of it. First of all, it would appear that animals dream. So the fact that animals dream will tell you that it's very likely that this is a real basal mechanism of mind, that, you know, there's some serious housekeeping of some kind that needs to be done. So it's thought that connections in memory systems, possibly pruning out things that are worthless, there could be a system in here where dreams are involved in this. Dreams themselves could be what we're going to call epiphenomena. In other words, they could be something that happens naturally as a result of some of the housekeeping processes that are taking place in that specific type of sleep, and that dreams are simply, they're like smoke to a fire. They're the result of the fire. They're not the cause of anything. Now, I'm not sure about that. It wouldn't surprise me if that turns out to be true. It may or may not be true. The one thing, though, that the dream state appears to be associated with, and that it appears to be associated with an increase in potential creativity. So let me give you an example of how this would work. During the dream state, the brain is getting a set of regular blasts of acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter, and this thing appears to be disrupting brain function on a systematic basis. And what is quite possible that's happening is the following, and that is that that when you are awake, of course, the purpose of your mind is ultimately to solve problems, and those problems are problems of choice. The choices that you are making, what you're attempting to do is you're attempting to evaluate all of the available evidence with respect to all factors in your life, and your job is to run an extraordinarily complex cost-benefit analysis on which values you should be taking action and which values you should not be taking action on. In other words, you are designed to set priorities for effective action in service of the genetic code. You don't know this, of course. You just do it, and what you're doing is you're attempting to feel as good as you can. Feelings are devices, both positive and negative, that are incentives and disincentives for actions that would be conducive to gene survival. So what the brain, that's the job of the brain. So we wouldn't necessarily expect that the brain would stop doing that job at night, but it might have to do some things. It might have to do a great deal of maintenance behavior, and we know that a tremendous amount of maintenance behavior for the body is taking place in sleep. And so it's also true that we would believe that there's a great deal of maintenance behavior that's taking place in the brain. So the brain is effectively cleaning up. There's a lot of byproducts of the neural activities during the day that build up inside the tissues of the brain, and they need to be flushed out of there for the brain to work efficiently. So the process of sleep is involving a great deal of housekeeping of the most sophisticated computer that you know, the universe, as best we know, has ever seen. Now, it's a very complicated apparatus that sits inside your skull, and its capabilities are breathtaking in terms of what this thing can do. Now, Now, the next thing that I have to say is this. You can be working on a problem when you are awake, and you can be stuck. There might be a very important problem. Your mind can sniff that there are significant evolutionary payoffs, and it's got your attention. And so your mind is working on this even when it doesn't, when you don't know that you're working on it. In other words, when you're conscious of other things, you're talking to somebody about, you know, the leak under the faucet, but you are still working on some, I don't know, some physics problem if you're a physicist. That brain is still working on that physics problem even though you are not consciously aware of that. We know that this is true. Now, it's going to turn out that it is a possibility that when you get stuck, that the basic logical operations of the brain are hitting a wall, so they can't figure it out. But what we might need is a completely different way of approaching the problem, or actually to scramble all the known evidence and to see if we can put it back together in a new way. So it appears that this is what dreaming does. So dreaming, by disrupting the neurochemistry of the brain, it essentially causes all the little pieces of the puzzle to be swirled around the coffee table as if this was a jigsaw puzzle and you were being stumped. So if we start moving the pieces around randomly, then we might suddenly have an insight because we see things now that get juxtaposed together that were not logically related to each other before, and so we were not seeing an essential connection that would allow us to see the solution to the puzzle. Now, this all sounds very exciting and elegant and dreamlike and et cetera, but it looks like it's true. So there's an experiment done, I can't remember when, it was in the early 2000s. This was, neuroscientists did this, and they had people attempting to solve some problem, some kind of a math-related problem that required some kind of leap of insight, but it actually looked like it was boring. I don't remember how this was done. But what I do remember was that when they allowed people to fall asleep and then come back and try to solve the problem, they solved the problem much faster. So this... I don't remember the details. I can dig it out. If somebody wants to write to me, I'll find it somewhere. It was very convincing. And what was also convincing was learning about these blasts of acetylcholine that are essentially disturbing all these elements all over the brain. So this looks like a solution when you get stumped by a problem is to essentially swirl around all the existing data points, all the existing evidence, swirl it around and mix it up. Because if you do that, there's a chance that the solution will arrive spontaneously. And this looks to be probably a useful component of dreaming that may be, for all we know, unique to human psychology. I don't know. So anyway, there's that. So that's what I know. Maintenance activity, this psychodynamic, stuff. Forget about that. This is, we're trying to figure this out from the standpoint of neurobiology. What would be the purpose of this? And so we have to look at it as possible epiphenomena. We have to look at it as an epiphenomena related to a bunch of house cleaning and maintenance activities, but it may be something else. It may be that this is a way to help a person who is stumped by a problem by conscious analysis to find a leap that allows them to solve a problem that they wouldn't ordinarily solve very efficiently, if at all. So there you have it.
Fascinating. Dr. Lyle, do you have any recurring dreams or any dreams that you can think of? That you have yourself?
I have. I have a few. I have a recurring dream that there's a class, usually Spanish, that I have to take in order to get my PhD. And I've known about the class and I started the class, but I have flaked out and we are near the end of the semester and I haven't even gone. and I'm not going to be able. I'm not going to be able to pull this thing off, and the whole doctorate is on the line.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the also I've had similar ones I think with a math class too, but mostly it's Spanish, and so anyway, then I'll wake up just this enormous relief that that I've got my degree, which is now I've had for 25 years. So yeah, so that's kind of an interesting thing where there's a for some reason in there the that is still related to the oh, you know what? I actually have thought through what this could be related to. I flaked out on a final tiny little thing that I was supposed to do for my PhD. So it was so trivial, you can't even imagine it. It was a little exercise that they instituted my year that would have taken me about an hour to do. It was ridiculous. And defending your dissertation, of course, at a major university is an enormous task. And so by the time I had gone through all the trouble preparing for 2 years to defend this thing, I then defended it at the University of Virginia, and everybody's shaking my hand, great job, blah, 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 when are you going to publish all this? Not everything. And there's this one little one-hour task that I supposed to do, and I never did it. So every now and then, I think that dream creeps in there too, but I have a feeling that strange little thing about the Spanish may be somehow related to the fact that I never did that task. So there you go. I'll go to my grave, and I will never do that.
Would you consider that an open loop in
your
life?
Yeah, I think that's an open loop, and I should have done it, but I'm now glad I didn't, because it enables me to look at that curiously as a potential of the human mind to set up a standing order for something. You know, we can see that it could have been important, because they could have come back to me a month later and said, hey, you know, what are you doing? You're supposed to get this done. But by that time, I already knew that all the paperwork had been filed and my dissertation was bound and it was all done. So there you have it. But it would still make sense that it was a rather important thing to flake out on. And anyway, so it's still lurking in there in my memory system. All right, let's go on to something more interesting. What else we got?
All right, dear Dr. Lyle, what is meditation, and does it actually, quote, work? Can I use it to reduce anxiety or, quote, clear my mind, end quote?
Well, I don't know much about this. You've got sort of states of consciousness. You've got different states of consciousness that can be sometimes quite remarkable. So if you've ever run into anybody that's sleepwalking, you know, that's quite entertaining. So your mind has sort of different states that it can be in. So it's not just conscious and unconscious. There's a variety of experiences that people can have based on what's happening in the brain at that time. So meditation is this thing that people do to try to get real quiet, and they're trying to, in theory, empty the mind, which is, of course, absurd. It can't be done. So the mind is a never-ending process of neurological activity that goes on from before you're born till the moment you die. So you can try to, quote, clear your mind, but you can't do this. Your mind is designed to be constantly processing sensory inputs and to be running cost-benefit analysis on alternative courses of action for gene survival. So you're not going to stop that from happening. Now, what might you do? Well, you might find little levers in there where you can hit things that you can essentially learn to alter neurotransmitter activity. So so I believe that you can go in there. I'm confident that I can do this. That I can go in there and activate endorphins. So I learned this by having a very severe painful condition, And I actually learned through some miracle, I learned how to activate the endorphin mechanism. It doesn't mean I can flood myself with heroin, but I can definitely make a substantial impact on pain within, you know, within 30 to 60 seconds. And I'm not the only one that does this. I mean, this is a you know, well-known phenomenon. Now, the so meditation, wow. Meditation can do something. It's probably something similar. And as a result, some people I have friends of mine that will meditate, and they will do this because they're these hyper conscientious, high achieving, competitive nutcases that are perfectionistic, and their mind is busy as a beehive. And they're always feeling the conscientiousness, like it's not quite good enough, it's not quite done enough, they're not quite ahead, they have to worry about this and that. So these are unusual people. These aren't normal people. And I believe that if we were to look at meditation and its popularity in the West, I think a lot of this is derived from probably highly intelligent, highly achieving, highly conscientious people that are looking for some relief. And so they give it a lot of cachet, and I think they give it a lot of cachet because they themselves can benefit. Now, I don't think that most people are going to benefit much of anything from this practice. But if you happen to be a highly conscientious, high anxiety human, then you may benefit quite a bit. The friends of mine that do this do benefit. It essentially dials down their anxiety a little bit. It gives them a relief for a period of time. I think some of them will claim that it will can help them all day long, which wouldn't surprise me. In other words, if there's an endorphin release that's taking place from doing this, just in the same way that if you, let's say you swim for 40 minutes in the morning, you can feel the endorphins from that process for hours, and it can kind of dial down your anxiety and make you feel more relaxed. So in the same way, meditation can undoubtedly, do this type of thing. So for people that experience a lot of anxious tension, and hopefully they know I'm being friendly and avuncular when I call them hyper-conscientious nutcases, these people are really valuable people. They're usually outstanding people in because of this super high conscientiousness. But that very conscientiousness that drives them to excellent achievement also doesn't allow them to relax very well. And so as a result, I think meditation is often, helpful for these folks. For the rest of us, I'm way more flaky than this, so I don't experience any of this kind of anxiety. And so but the same similar process, I believe, is what I have found with the pain management. I don't have the same pain now, but there was a period of time a few years ago where I got injured in a sports accident, and I had acute pain that required me to find some solution, and this was the solution that worked, which was a meditative like state. So that's my long-winded answer to can it work. The answer is yeah, it can do things, and if you happen to be somebody that needs something, this might be something that could be useful for you.
Fantastic. All right. Well, this leads right to the next question regarding meditation in general. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lyle, I recall you likening the inability to change your personality or feelings to the inability to change one's response to pain. However, if meditation can allow people to overcome pain and the startle response, etc., wouldn't this suggest that newer parts of the brain could be altered as well?
Oh God, I don't even know if I can follow this question. So, you're gonna have to read that whole thing to me again, so I can actually see if I can understand what they're trying to say. Do it again. Start from the top.
Dear Dr. Lyle, I recall
that
you likening.
Okay, go ahead. All right.
I recall you likening the inability to change your personality and feelings to the inability to change one's response to pain.
Slow down. Okay. The inability to changing your personality and feelings. Okay, well, the let's be careful here. Your personality is your personality. Your feelings can change dramatically depending upon circumstances. All right. Now, so then and changing your response to pain. Well, you can't change your response to pain and the fact that if I take out a ball peen hammer and hit your big toe, you're going to have the same response as people are going to have worldwide. So we're not going to change that. Now, so far, I'm not quite sure what they're saying. Keep going.
Ah, okay. So yeah. If meditation can allow people to overcome pain.
Okay. Now, meditation is going to meditative-like state or an altered state of consciousness or the ability to find mental and physical mechanisms, basically find mechanisms to where it is that you can alter, neural activity. Yes. So meditation, meditative-like things, I wouldn't call it meditation per se, but meditative-like processes like hypnosis, et cetera, there are these altered states and gimmicks that a person can learn that can alter their pain experience. That is true. Okay, so go ahead.
Allow people to overcome pain, the startle response, etc.
Wait a second. I don't think you're going to overcome the startle response. So no, that isn't going to happen. So the startle response is a super rapid automated mechanism that you will not overcome. So, right, I'm not sure where they got the idea that you could do that. Go ahead.
Wouldn't this suggest that, quote, newer, end quote, parts of the brain could be altered as well?
Wait a second. The startle response is not going to be altered. The pain mechanism is not, to think that it's an older part of the brain and older and newer, this doesn't make any sense. So they're now leaping into a territory of new versus old parts of the brain. Doesn't make any sense to me. So so I'm not sure what they're saying. So keep going from here.
That was it. That was the question.
That was it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm not even sure what they're asking. So are there ways to, I read the whole
Maybe
thing from the top and I'll see if I can get a question out of it.
Okay. Yeah, this wasn't my question, but maybe what they're trying to say, I can kind of take a guess at this.
Okay.
Is if the meditative techniques in a meditative state can allow people to overcome a feeling, which is pain.
Okay.
Does this suggest that, and they probably used completely wrong terminology, but my thinking is, does this suggest that someone who has, for example, maybe is extremely disagreeable can change the way that they feel, they don't feel angry or upset as often.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. Good for you. Here's the deal. That the meditative state can temporarily change what's happening. So you could be very, very stressed and anxious. And in a meditative state, you could go in there and sort of alter these levers a little bit and change some neurotransmitter flow. You could have a... there's places you can go in imagery, so your brain can start looking for knowledge structures to say, like, well, really, how bad is it? Where are we really? Are we being attacked by lions? Blah 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 blah. So there's, aren't we really safe? I'm now aware that I'm actually in my living room on a nice, warm rug, and everything is safe, and I'm in the back of a cul-de-sac, and I really don't have to do that much, and it's no disaster happening, and I am healthy, etc. Yeah, we might try to clear our mind, but you can forget it. You're not clearing anything. But what can happen is that you can start to access knowledge structures that start to change what's going on, which neural circuits are being activated in the brain. And you can activate neural structures that are going to result in reducing your anxiety and creating a greater sense of pleasantness. Okay? Now, that is clear. That's not magic and meditation. You can also have that by looking at your bank account, and it turns out there's $5,000 more in there than you thought there was. Okay? So information changes things. And so as a result, if you learn to look for information inside your head that puts your life in a better perspective and reduces some of the anxiety as a result, good for you. And you can call that meditation, you can call that cognitive therapy, you can call it whatever you want. And if you do it real still and it's all quiet and who knows, there's some nice, you know, rhythmic music playing in the background or not, who knows what how this works. But the bottom line is can you access some data analysis that actually calms the system down? And if that's true, you know, are there other levers that can be hit, for example, that might reduce your pain? Yes. Reduce your anxiety? Yes. Okay. Now, is that going to carry forward when you wake up and the phone rings and the IRS says, hey, you know, when do you want to schedule your audit for? It's like, trust me, that same highly conscientious individual is now back up at 100 miles an hour. We didn't change their personality with this. Okay, so the injury that I had, I could knock down that pain for a while. If I'd get up and move around, re-aggravate it, pain comes back. Okay, so what we're talking about is we're talking about shifting temporarily the state of where the brain is at. That you can do, that can be relieving, and that can be useful. We're not changing anybody's personality, and we're not, yeah, so forget about it. Not going to happen. So if somebody that, like, wants to meditate to become less disagreeable, good luck. I don't expect there's going to be I don't expect that there's going to be much evidence that we're going to get very far with that.
Fantastic.
All right. Go ahead.
All right, we got a question, then we got a caller on hold as well. So,
oh, okay.
Dear Dr. Lyle, is there an...
Okay, go ahead.
Let's take a caller. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, just one second here. Dylan, welcome to the program.
Dylan.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
Dylan from Phoenix, longtime listener.
Yeah.
So I'm good, thank you. So I've got a question. I'm not going to ask my original question because now we're on this other thing.
Okay.
But I've never thought to ask you about this, Dr. Lyle, but it was actually a really significant part of my growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of this altered state of mind thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom told me that when I was only a few days old, I would lay on my stomach and lift my head up and bang my forehead over and over and over,
mm-hmm,
slowly in the cradle.
Yeah.
And then as I got older, when I started actually being conscious, if
mm-hmm
you will,
yeah,
I was continuing to do this all through grade school, and I would sometimes I'd get up on my knees. This is my bedtime ritual.
Yeah.
And I would get on my knees and I would repeatedly bang my head over and over and over. Sometimes,
uh-huh,
rarely, to the,
yeah,
point where I would like have some soreness on my forehead, even and some redness, you know?
Yeah.
But and then I'd finally fall asleep and that was the end of it. And also, mm-hmm, as I was a little bit older, not as a baby, I would also lay on my right side and I'd roll over onto my back and then back onto my right side over,
mm-hmm,
and over and over until I finally fell asleep.
Yeah.
And I never realized really what was going on during that time until I was a little older. I was certainly not meditative because it was quite the opposite. I was not calming my mind in the slightest.
Yeah.
I was deep in thought,
mm-hmm,
like playing out every scenario of a possible situation, like,
uh-huh,
solving through problems while I was rolling back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'd do it with like loud music on when I got older, like when I was in college.
Right.
I would do it with loud music. And then finally I just stopped doing it. Maybe when I met my wife,
mm-hmm,
where I had more serious girlfriends like between college and when I met my wife. I'm not sure,
mm-hmm,
when it was. But over 10 years ago, I just kind of stopped doing it. But,
right,
and now the whole hyper-conscientious thing,
mm-hmm,
I've tried to meditate. But,
mm-hmm,
I've kind of, you know, kind of like a person struggles with switching to a whole food plant-based diet. There's,
right,
the extinction curve, and it's really hard to get into it. And,
mm-hmm,
so it's always fallen off, and I never got to a state where I was actually able to calm my mind, which,
mm-hmm,
is funny because what I was always trying to do as a kid was make my mind race through all of these things and solve all of these deep problems that I was working on. And now I don't have that outlet, if you will. And I've looked to meditation to sort of like, but incorrectly, because clearly I'm not searching for the same meditative state. So, Have you ever heard of that? What was that?
Do you like the headbanging and so forth? I know that this is a thing that's been observed in people. So this is not a unique thing to you, and something is probably known about it. What strikes me about this is that this is going to be potentially something involved with the problem of competing neural circuits. So your mind has, think of it as a massive international corporation, and it has little companies all over the world, thousands of them. And it has companies that are actually own some other companies. So it's hierarchical. Some of them, there are localized companies in Shanghai that own 50 companies in Shanghai. And but they all ultimately, all of the processes are ultimately, you know, there's balance sheets reported to the head honcho. I don't know where he lives. I'm going to call it London. Okay? So all over the place. There is cost-benefit analysis being run on every bit of land, labor, and capital that is involved in the economic problem of this company, which is to optimize rate of return. Okay, and so as a result, a local company says, gosh, if we'd only have new tile floor in here, we're pretty sure we could make more sales. I think that would really be worth it. Okay. And some other company says, we need a 12,000-square-foot warehouse because we've got a whole bunch of used tires that are coming in here, and we could turn those into rubber and we could, you know, make spacesuits out of them. I don't know. So the point is that you have a bunch of localized circuits, and ultimately you've got at the top, you've got a decision maker that is basically saying, this is what we're going to do. Okay. And 2 seconds later, all the database changes a little bit, and then he says, this is now what we're going to do about this. And the most important thing, the system is designed by nature to try to get the most important thing to the attention of the organism. That's how it's built. It's built with hierarchical structures, able to actually organize value assessment mechanisms to try to on earth to figure out what on earth is the most important thing that we should be doing with our time at this instant. That is a problem of phenomenal complexity. Now, you can imagine that there could be competition essentially between neural circuits. The guys in the Philippines are screaming for new ships. So are the guys in Athens. They both believe they've got a case. Okay, they believe that the next $1 billion in revenue ought to go to them because they could need a new fleet of ships. There's noise all over the system. But you can see how the system is trying to find its way to distribute the neural energy that it has and to make these computations. You can even see the possibility that it could see that it needs to distract itself away from certain things so that it can actually concentrate more effectively on others. Okay? This is why it is that you might bang your head or that you might roll from side to side, that it would be a way to actually quiet down or drown out. It's like white noise. So that some other competing demands cannot work their way up and steal consciousness away from what the system is suspecting is the most important problem. Okay?
That makes
perfect
sense.
So that's what I think is happening. So that's where I think that probably comes from. Yeah, go ahead. What were you thinking?
I was going to say, now sometimes with me not doing that,
yeah,
I wonder, like, I see myself in situations like I'll be at dinner and I'll kind of zone out of conversations more because I haven't spent downtime, like, altering my state of consciousness into this thing that you're explaining. And so, like, is it causing me to be less present because I've put in less hours at, you know, thinking and rolling, if you will, because I don't do it anymore?
Yeah, I don't know. But if you're not present at dinner, it's because your mind is wandering off trying to find the most important thing, and it's not at the dinner. Yeah. That's what your mind's doing. It is relentless seeking the most valuable thing that it can be doing. So if I start getting boring, boom, your brain starts drifting off because it's like, wait a second, you got to start trying to figure out what's the most important thing for you to be paying attention to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is how the mind works. So it isn't shocking to find that there might be some funny-looking behavior that could result in actually superior focus as far as the brain can figure out in terms of its ability to actually solve problems better if we bang our head or crack our knuckles, you know what I'm saying? Or famously, Aristotle would walk, peripatetic. Okay, so this is I think it was him. Hope I got that right. That's the idea, is that get some circuits, you know, essentially busy and quieting down probably some other circuits that are fighting their way to try to get conscious attention. So anyway, that's my thinking on that, and I think that's probably what was going on. Strange little thing. Hope you don't have too much brain damage. Sounds like you came out of it okay.
It worked out all right.
Okay.
Well, I can save my other question if you guys got other stuff to talk about for next time if you want.
Appreciate no, Dylan, that. Come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that? What do you think, Nate?
Yeah, Dylan, go ahead with your other question. That's no problem.
Yeah, go ahead with your other question. We'll make this the last thing of the night. Go right ahead.
Okay. So I think it's about introversion, extroversion, but
okay.
Maybe there's something more going on. When I go out to, say, like, I'm volunteering at an event, for example, mm-hmm. with a bunch of people that I've never met, I
yeah.
feel really introverted and not – I don't want to say, hi, I'm Dylan, what do you do, and make strike up conversation.
Right.
Even though – if I did, I'd do fine at it. You know, I've
sure.
forced myself to do it once in a while,
right.
but it's not my like natural thing that I want to do.
Right.
And if I go like out with my wife and we're around a lot of her friends, that maybe I'm a little acquainted with them, but they don't kind of know my whole thing. So what am I thinking in my head? Like, I don't want to have to get them up to speed. I don't know. But
right.
if I'm around a group where I have like, I guess maybe a bunch of status, or they're there to listen to me talk about something I know about. Oh, we want to talk about a plant-based diet or about urban farming or solar power, things that, you know, they know I know something about, or, I don't know, something to that effect. I'm super extroverted. And I
yeah.
could, like, jam with you guys all night about this, and we don't really,
right.
like, know each other per se. So is it introversion, extroversion, or something else, or how could I
yeah.
do better? How can I explain to my wife why I seem so introverted in some situations without any kind of rational explanation?
Right. Okay. So here's the problem. So we have to – personality characteristics are a there's two – what we're going to do to answer this is we're going to step the camera back for a second, and we're going to cleave the problem of psychology into two different halves. I actually wouldn't call them in half. I'd call it 25-75. But conceptually, just for fun, we're going to call it in half. One part is we're going to call it general psychology. That would be equivalent to Gray's Anatomy. So that's that. You know, now you see why it would be 75% for general psychology. It is unbelievably complicated to figure out Gray's Anatomy. You have to figure out how the kidney works and how the pancreas works, and how they work together. It's like, oh, my God, really complicated. Now, the second part of the equation is the individual differences between pancreases. That guy has a big pancreas. That guy's pancreas isn't working, and he's got a disease. Okay, that's interesting. The individual differences are very interesting. They're actually not nearly as complicated conceptually as understanding the system in general. That is the equivalent of personality. So personality is the individual difference issues between people. General psychology, or general evolutionary psychology, if you want to call it that, is the massive problem of Gray's Anatomy of the mind. How does the whole damn thing work, and why in this particular species? Okay? Now, the overarching, over the top of all this, is the nature of motivation, which is cost-benefit analysis. So if you're trying to figure out why anybody's doing anything, you have to take into account two different things. You have to take into account general psychological principles, which are going to involve the cost-benefit analysis process of gene survival, the whole nature of motivation. And then you say, okay, I understand that everybody's running a cost-benefit analysis on every social situation, but why do some people run it differently than others? And the answer is, well, for one reason, they're just genetically different, introversion, extroversion. But another reason is that the nature of the social situation is completely different than the one that we had last night. Okay? The cost-benefit is entirely different. So as a result, we would expect there to be a lot more energy and excitement when it turns out that there is more status to be gained. And when it turns out that there isn't a lot of status to be gained, then we're not going to generate much energy and excitement. So so when someone is reclusive, there's two options for understanding them. One is maybe they're an introvert, and the other is maybe they don't think anybody's really worthwhile. And if they run into a bunch of people that they think are worthwhile, suddenly they turn into a social animal. Okay? So this So hopefully this starts making sense, and let's not share this with your wife, because apparently this is saying something about her friends.
Well, she's so extroverted, I could turn around and she'll be holding someone's baby that we've never seen before, and I'm
right.
Like, how can I do that?
Yeah, why and what? We wouldn't even want to do it, etc. And the swirling around those individual differences, introversion, extroversion, are these sort of probably very deep subconscious possible inferences about infection, and so they're just individual differences in how. It's a risk-reward ratio of banging too many elbows and too many lips with other people. And so some of us are born with a more conservative chip in this regard, and some of us are born with a more outgoing liberal chip or high-risk chip. So your wife is a little higher risk, you're a little lower risk, and unless the people are hell of interesting, forget it. This reminds me, by the way, this will be our close. I have a friend of mine who is OCD. I have many friends that are OCD, but this one is kind of entertaining in the fact that he, in his history as a swashbuckling lover, he had to fight his germ phobia if he was going to get nasty with anybody. So even kissing had a cost-benefit analysis that had to be run through the system pretty carefully. And, of course, the issue would be, well, how attractive is the female? So if the female is attractive, well, then in that case, we can manage to override all the germ phobia. If the female is not so attractive, then maybe we don't. So there you have it. Introversion, extroversion, your wife's friends, the whole nine yards. That's the story.
Right. I'm just an ass at the end of the day.
There you go. All right. Dylan. Thanks for calling, Dylan.
Thank you.
Dylan, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it. Dr. Lyle, have a good night. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.